Everybody, it's Jim Mallard here. Welcome to the Mallard Report. The Mallard Report is recorded in front of a live virtual audience on the Duck Pond. Tuesday nights, 9 p.m. Eastern, live. Mallard.com. M-A-L-L-I-A-R-D.com. One more thing before we start. Let me turn it over to my friend that you may know from Ancient Aliens and the Curse of Oak Island and many other things, Robert Clotworthy.
On the Mallard Report, the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed on the show are solely those of the hosts and guests and not necessarily of Evergreen Podcasts, KillerPodcast.com, sponsor or affiliate, or any other individual or group. On the Mallard Report, the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in the show are solely those of the hosts and guests and not necessarily of Evergreen Podcasts, KillerPodcast.com, sponsor or affiliate, or any other individual or group.
In case you're wondering, the intro is 50 seconds. There we go. I redid it, and I was just talking to Dave, and I couldn't remember how long it was. So for somebody out there needs to remind me, the intro is 50 seconds. Anyways, my guest tonight is David Perodin, Dr. David Perodin, the author of Velocity of Information, and in the School of Errors. David, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. So, it is warm here in southern Wisconsin, and when I say warm, 88 and humid, and a week ago it was 40 and windy and snowy. So it was
40 like, with 88% humidity.
It was crazy. So I'm trying to quickly adapt, you know, to this new climate that we have here in the past 48 hours. But I'm doing great. And Jim, thank you so much for inviting me back to the show. I love the Mallard Report, and I've been fortunate to have been a guest in the past, so thank you for having me back on the show.
Well, I want to thank you for coming back on, and I want to thank you for the book and all the fun conversations we've had. Okay, but enough of the love. Let's get to the topic du jour of the night, the velocity information. So for the viewer or listener out there who hasn't had the opportunity to pick that up, give me the scoop.
Yes, so it was in February of 2020, right? I was doing a professional presentation about safety, right, and planning ahead for different safety events. And it was in that presentation, I added a five-minute part at the end, and I said, you know, you might want to start preparing for the pandemic, right? It was just one of those things that started to be on the news a little bit. And, of course, you know, a few weeks later, you know, March of 2020, we're in the pandemic. I realized at that moment, I had the opportunity to write about chaos as it was unfolding in real time. So I went about doing that, right? I was observing what was happening around me because I expected this was going to be unlike anything we had encountered, right, in 100+ years. And it was probably going to last a long time, right? And this would unfold in ways which we didn't know. So I start to do an outline, reached out to my publisher for my first book and said, hey, I have this idea about writing about how humans react to long periods of chaos, more than like a couple days, you know, chaos that would last months. And I put together the proposal, they approved it, and I went ahead and I started to, you know, document and write and research what this looked like in the past and start to bring that. Did interviews, right? I was going and interviewing, not just interviewing people about the pandemic and you know, protest and things like that, shortages, but interviewing people like Robert Travis, an Alaskan crab boater, and saying, hey, like, you know, you're on a crab boat for two seasons, over 100 days. How did you survive chaos, like, and not just mentally burning out? Because he said some people did, you know, like 2 weeks and they'd be like, I can't handle this anymore and stuff like that. So I thought it was an incredible asset to again have this book published. It came out in April. It's in hard copy ebook and paperback, and then it'll also be an audiobook, but that will come out next year. It's done. It just by contract can't come out until next year. One of the things that I wrote about right away in the book, and I wasn't anticipating this, Jim. So schools, right? Schools closed down by state orders, in March of 2020, and my kids like weren't going to school, and my youngest daughter was in elementary school, and I could start to see, like, you know, she was wondering, well, what's going on, right? Because I always went to school. Now school's closed. I can't go to the playground because that's closed. My friends can't come over. I can't go to their place. I can't go with, you know, mom and dad to the stores, right? So I could start, and her friends were emailing her and telling her what they thought was going on. They thought that the playgrounds were being ripped out, right? And all of, you know, the stores are being shut down and things like this. So I was watching her get very anxious, right? And I didn't know what to tell her because, well, I could tell her what was going on, but I really had to take her, right? I sat down and said, what's concerning you? And I had my own concerns, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I was going to say.
I'm kind of like, yeah, Dad's got worries here too. You know, I want to figure out what's happening at the armory on the side of town here with the airport. You know, are they bringing in, you know, pallets of supplies and, you know, a bunch of Humvees there, or what's going on? But so we sat down and made this list of places we wanted to go. So she wanted to go to her school. She wanted to go to a couple playgrounds, and, you know, we go to the Walmart in town. And I said, well, let's go to the hospital too. And then, you know, the armory. And so we had, you know, maybe like 7-8 places where we had been before. And so I got the tripod and the camcorder. I said, all we're going to do is just like, we're going to make a little show, right? Like, we're not going to put it live on the internet, but, and she loves to do video editing type stuff. So I said, you know, we'll pretend we're doing the news, right? And I wrote about that in the book. So there's a chapter devoted to that of helping young people move through time, because for her, everything kind of stopped, right? You're used to new experiences as a kid. You try to pattern this to other things, and you're like, you know, it hasn't happened before. So you get stuck. And so I needed to transition her forward. I needed to give her new events. So we actually did 13 of these videos and over like 4 months. But we went out to the park and set up the tripod. And yeah, the police tape is around it. There's a picture in the book of the park we went to, which is pretty close to our house. And then there's this big pile of sand. And that's where her friend was saying, oh, they're like digging out the park and or the playground. And that wasn't the case. The sand was there because they were putting in volleyball courts. But yeah, if you're maybe, you know, 9 years old, right, driving by with your parent and you look at that, you'd be like, wow, like what's going on? And it was amazing because I would say, what do you think you're going to see? So we do a little bit before, like, what do you think is going to be happening at Walmart when we go to in the parking lot? And then when we got there, you know, like, what do you actually see? Well, you can only go in one way, right? And people are kind of spaced apart. I'm like, okay. And, you know, why are they spaced apart? And then I would say, well, there's X's that you stand on. And then, you know, they space people out when they go in, but you can still go in. And, you know, that hasn't changed. Like, it's not shut down. And she got to go to her school. She took a picture. You know, she's standing in front of the door where it says, you know, school's closed or whatever. But it became very real for her. She's saying, I observed, which is huge. I have another part in the book of how when people say I observed versus just repeating, like, they said, you know, they said this is happening. And kind of like her friend, they said they're ripping out the playgrounds. And all of us, like we hear on the media or people who just kind of pass headlines to us, which is kind of a human nature, right, to pass negative, sensationalized news instead of digging into it. So she got really good at I observed. It was great for me to be able to study and to write about this. And for my own, I had the Member Check Network, which I wrote about in the book too. And Brian Bowden, who I think was in the chat here a moment ago. Brian was in my Member Check Network. And Brian's in the book. So, and he is, and I introduced Brian as being on the travel channel. So, I gave him an awesome title, which he was.
Yes.
So but Brian was part of my Member Check Network, and I had about five, six people for about every 3 days. I would check in with them, and we would say, this is like March, April, May, June, July, What are you observing? And Brian did little videos, and he would share them with the group, about 4 minute long videos of here's what is happening in his part of the Bronx. And I had another friend, Charles Mack, who is the head of IT, University of Pittsburgh Medical, and Chuck would tell us what was happening there. And not like the medical stuff, not like who's being admitted or who's not being admitted, but stuff like that they increased telemedicine in 2 weeks by 10 times, right? That they were taking, he moved in to work. He couldn't go home. So he had a couch and a dorm fridge, and he just lived there training people nonstop, and any device that they could use, a tablet, a phone, an old laptop, a security camera, you know, as a webcam. I mean, he was on top of it. I talked to him the other day, and I said, I wish I would have called that heading for you. I would have called you the Pittsburgh Batman. I said, because you were the Batman. You were the hero, right, that University of Pittsburgh needed at the time. And I don't know what I had for that. But I said, from now on, you are the Pittsburgh Batman. And but you know, he was the first one also to get essential papers. So he took a picture of his essential papers, and he was stopped several times on the way to and from work. He also had Pittsburgh, their newspaper. I don't know whatever the newspaper is in Pittsburgh, but you could log in, you could access through the newspaper on your phone, and it would show you where the COVID positive areas were in town. So I have a picture of that in the book. He sent me a screenshot. So imagine, like, if you go on your phone and you can see your neighborhood, and it's like, oh, like, it wasn't specific to a house, but it could be like, this area has a high density of blue. It's like very blue, meaning there's a lot of COVID. So maybe, like, I don't know, you don't deliver pizzas there. I mean, no one really knew what this meant. So we were watching it. And then I had another friend in Washington State who their police department, we have a video of it. Their police department on their website wanted you to report gatherings. And they had a Google map. You could drag over the address of the person. You could take your own photos. So we were kind of like, well, you know, there's two reasons you do that, right? During the start of a chaos event, either you try to enroll people to give them purpose, or you're trying to increase your kind of enforcement. So it's like, which one of these was it? And we saw things happening, you know, like the coin shortage, you know, as that started to roll, and what it meant to us. And like, should you get more currency? Should you try to up your credit? Like, what was going to happen? One of the things that was interesting is Brian, when Brian observed that the yard workers were out in the Bronx with their leaf blowers and cleaning stuff up. And he said, hey, like, that is something 2 weeks ago, right? Everybody would have been calling the police and, you know, how can you be out here and everything. So he said that was a turning point. So having this network of maybe 5-6 people that I was checking in with every 3 days, and we were, you know, doing these observations of what we were authentically observing was great for finding out what was happening, right? And how we could kind of prepare ourselves. Again, you know, we're going to run into a situation where you're going to be credit only for what you're paying for. And I did the research on it too, Jim. So I had research studies of saying, you know, if you, with anything, if you can get, you know, about 5 people together, and not like, this is one of the things. So if you go back to the, 1918 pandemic, right? If you got 5 people together and you're having them observe what and tell you what's going on, they're probably all people in your house or like people on your block or on your farm. They're not from around the country, right? Because you don't really have a means to communicate with them. So, but if you can get 5 people from different areas and to tell you, they're all observing and giving you information, that increases your intelligence of what's happening, like through the roof. And I think that was a big part of the book too. You don't need these huge, complicated networks and systems. You really need, you know, about 5 people you can trust who are not going to be sucked into the, they call it negative vicarious rehearsal, or like just the where the bad news overtakes you and that's all you can think about. And so, yeah, I mean, I guess So those things are in the book, and I interviewed 10 people. I talked about Robert Travis. I interviewed Nikolai Razavayu. Nikolai Razavayu was a Soviet national cyclist in the 1980s. So he was 20 years old in 1986 when the Chernobyl nuclear disaster happened in April of 1986. Of course, very close to Kyiv. He had to bike in Kyiv the next day. And he said, you know, so in Kyiv, right, he said they're soaping up the streets and, you know, hosing down buildings, but they don't tell you what's going on, right? So he snuck out at night with his Selga transistor radio because the KGB would lower their jamming signals at night. So he could hear Radio Liberty coming in, you know, maybe from like Poland or Sweden or whatever. And then he was able to get to a high point and get radio reception. And then they were talking about, you know, the Chernobyl nuclear fire, right, and radiation and stuff like that. And even then he had, you know, he's like, well, you know, how truthful is this? This is, you know, propaganda trying to be, you know, is this accurate? But then he was seeing other things, right? When he did a practice run or practice bike trek, he biked past nearly a kilometer of buses that had lead shields on top of them, and they were there to evacuate the children. And then also, so I think, like, you know, Kyiv has like 2 million people in it. So all of these things were starting to add up. And, you know, there were rumors going around. And then as bicyclists, right, you know, Soviet national cyclists, they were told to drink red wine. That's kind of weird, right? Like, I bike and don't drink wine before I bike. But the thought was it would mitigate the effects of radiation. So, but that was amazing to hear when you're not getting state information, right, from the Soviet Union. You're not being told what's happening. Face validity. What do you actually see in front of you? Face validity. And as you said, when I saw the roads being soaked up, when I saw the buses, you know, these were things telling me something big is going on here. So that is a fascinating interview. I interviewed Linda Stone, who was an executive with Microsoft. And Linda is an expert on attention, how we use our attention. And one of the things that I learned is, and I didn't know this, you know, this whole thing of kind of multitasking, right? Because you're at home now, right? Instead of going to a job, so your home is your office. Maybe your kids are at home doing online school and just everything else. And she said, you know, you can only attend to so many things. We use our attention where we focus on something and then we focus on something else and focus on something else. It's serial. It's very rapid. We shift it. We don't really split it. So that was something too of saying, you know, in the book, like, understand your attention. And if you can do a meeting with audio only versus Zoom, people will typically have a much higher attention because they don't have to encode all of the video, you know, the visuals of it. So I thought that was really a cool interview. And I'll give you one more, and then it was Aaron Sawyer. Aaron Sawyer owns Redline VR, virtual reality, in Chicago. And so his virtual reality business was just thriving. So people come in and, you know, they put on the 3D, you know, goggles, right? And the haptic wearables. So, you know, you're fighting your zombie. I mean, it actually kind of feels like you're doing something, right? And his business was deemed non-essential. So he was shut down. And so he's like, whoa, you know, how am I going to keep things going? And a weird thing happened, though, Jim. So in Chicago, you know, people who were told, you know, you have to stay at home, you can't come into the office. So they're in a tiny, like, you know, apartment or something like that. They start to show up at his virtual reality place, and they're knocking on the door, and they're saying, hey, like, can we come in here and just, you know, do our remote work for an hour or two? We'll pay you. And he's like, I'm not an office. I can't do this. And then he looked into it, and for $250, he could get a license to be an office. So I have the ad that he put online in the book. He put an ad out, and he said, hey, you can rent office space, I don't know, like $15 a day or like $60 a week, something novel, right? And people did it. they came in, and these stations that were virtual reality gaming stations, he just put, you know, like a shower curtain between them, and people came in and they had the Wi-Fi. And so one of the things that's really neat about that is not so much Aaron Sawyer pivoting to turn into an office, but it's the fact that people in chaos, people who have the routines really disrupted, they still need to do a start and end ritual. And that's what, and I would say, interview these people, ask them why they're coming to you. And he said, you know, they're saying, hey, like, I'm getting up at 2 a.m. to check work emails. Like, I'm just so used to a start and end. I can't do this, right? I need some place to go. So that was a fascinating part of the book too, of how, you know, we need rituals. We need a start and end time. It's actually called Parkinson's Law. And so, like, what do you do for, you know, yourself or for your kids, or even, you know, could be your parents or other people who've lost this kind of start and end time to things. You know, you superimpose it, you put it back in. So that was really cool. Like, I interviewed Larry Lawton, America's biggest jewel thief, and I had one question for him, and it was, you know, about face validity, how do you get information? And, you know, Larry Lawton, 1.5 million, you know, YouTube followers, and I said, how'd you find out about 9/11? Because, you know, Larry Lawton spent a lot of his time, you know, in a solitary confinement, right? And, you know, really and he said, nobody asked me that. So he's going through the process of how information goes through prison, and the prison system was in lockdown on 9/11. So, like, nothing was coming in and out. So it was amazing to do this interview and to write about it in the book of, how do you get information too when kind of your traditional streams of information get shut down? So it is a fascinating. It's very conversational when you go through it. It's 208 pages, and yeah, the early reviews have been great about it. I don't think there's anything out there that objectively addresses how humans function in long periods of chaos, right? I'll say long, like more than 90 days. And it doesn't tilt into a conspiracy theory or kind of political leanings. It just goes very objectively, you know, down the center of the row, but there's a lot in it. But yeah, there we go.
Okay. So, I've got a question for you, and I've got a question for Germantown Runner in the pond here. I was thinking I wanted to give the book a gold star, but that kind of seems cheesy and not off-brand. So for the people on the pond, I need to figure out what my award for books is so we can give it to books that we like around here. Anyways, back to you. Amazon, where can people find you and find the book before we start diving into some of the more of the gritty of the rest of the world?
Right. Right. Probably the easiest way to find me is safetyphd.com. That's my website, safetyphd.com, which is current. So, you know, there's information about me, information about the books. I do a podcast, the Safety Doc podcast, which I also reference in the book, because sometimes the only way I could really get to people was through the podcast, right? So that's how I got Larry Lawton. He was a guest on my podcast, and we did another interview. So safetyphd.com. The Safety Doc podcast has 181 episodes, and then I do a write-up on those. So a lot of things in the book. And recently, like the last few months, I've kind of taken parts of the book and have done readings. And the book is available, obviously, Amazon, places that sell book, your local bookstore, you know, if you can support your local bookstore, but Barnes & Noble. But yeah, it'll be easy to find that. When you're searching for that, you'll also find my first book, School of Heirs, which is coming out in paperback in summer. So that book will have a more affordable price point, plus audiobook on that one comes out in summer, narrated by me. And you know, you'll see that. But Philosophy of Information has this beautiful blue cover with this.
Nice.
I loved what my publisher did with this. There were 5 options on the cover. We narrowed it down to it, and this one was just it's just amazing. So the book immediately is like, you know, it's your coffee table book, right? It's the book on the shelf. You're like, what is that? It's this Philosophy of Information.
So, speaking of, okay, so this is gonna be a fun segue because this ties to a Germantown runner question, but I've got to bring it up. I was on your show. I was on like 59 or something like that. We talked about the text messages over in Hawaii about how that was short-term misinformation, though, but it was pretty scary. But Germantown Runner wants me to ask you, according to an appearance on CNN, I have to mention that because that's causing some problems in the chat room, FDA chief Dr. Robert Cutliffe asserted that the leading cause of death in the United States is online, quotes, misinformation. Is it?
Oh, yeah, I think I saw that. I mean, what a crazy quote to put out there, right? So, I mean, how would you even try to measure that, you know? So, I would say no, right? I don't see that. Now, I would say this book gives you like tools and shortcuts and processes, again, that member check network, things like that, to help you get more reliable information. But it also opens your mind to, we are in a place, like we're getting close to intersecting where it's going to be hard to authenticate some information, right? Here's an example. So I wrote about how Fox Sports, during the 2020 Major League Baseball season, put Avatar fans in the stands, and they put it in, and they would talk about it as they did it. There was actually a tweet of like 37 seconds, and they said, well, here's a game between like the Cubs and the Brewers, and we can make the stadium look like it's 80% full and Brewers fans. And so they're showing this, and I'm like, wow, that is amazing. And that's also terrifying, because you could do that for a crowd at a protest, right? Or you could do that for a crowd outside of a grocery store or something. I mean, there's so many ways you could deep fake and avatar realism, which I talked about on PBS back in 2019. So, you know, there's these things where I'm getting more and more nervous. Like when when the current administration came out with the disinformation czar, I thought, okay, like that person might be the face of trying to get at deepfakes and avatars and bots and algorithms. But that wasn't the case at all, right? That person didn't come out with that platform. Was more of saying, we're going to just take existing statements from people or people's positions, and then we will amend them to put a filter of truth. And I'm like, that's wow. You know, not where I would be putting my resources right now, considering where we're at with deep fakes and avatar realism. So yeah, velocity of information, if you're going to be there someday actually seeing something, right, in 10, 15 years, but are you really seeing it and experiencing, or is it like a holographic event that's happening? We're not quite there yet, but I mean, it gets people thinking how carefully we have to be stewards of our information and working together, you know, with that. So, but yeah, I saw that, I saw that today, and I'm like, no, I don't believe misinformation. I think it's mosquito bites that's killing most of the people, so at least where I live.
Could be a lot of things.
So, yeah.
So the legend Germantown Runner has another question. I'm glad he's back and healthy and doing well, by the way. He's on the mend, I think. I can fairly say that certainly for him. I'm going to argue the point that remote learning was a failure. I mean, my kids do it and are fairly successful at it. But overall, of course, my kids go to a cyber charter school, which was designed to teach kids online, compared to school districts who are just, oh, shit, we've got to do this. So, I mean, there's a difference. But during the shutdown, I mean, he wants to know, did that set kids back on a mass scale or whatever? I'm assuming it did, because, like I said, I know I was talking to some parents who had kids still in the brick and mortar, and then they got shut down and they were getting packets and all kinds of crap. So.
Right. And I teach, you know, university level classes for school administrators. I teach three a year. So in addition to, you know, my own kids and monitoring kind of what they were getting and how they were required to interact at certain times of the day, log in, and I had a pretty good feel for what was going on. Right. So as you said, Jim, you're right on. Most of this was never meant to be moved from brick and mortar to virtual, like, and or even toggle back and forth. So the fidelity in that, no one had ever studied that. It was a big mess, pretty much everywhere, right? And so I think that's pretty certain. One of the things I think it showed, I mean, some capabilities that, you know, things that could be done if they were put together, you know, the right way and stuff. But will it show up as this big achievement gap? And I'm not completely sold that that's going to manifest in the next 8 or 10 years. I think, you know, kids, I don't know if what we're teaching right now, I think things are changing so rapidly, right? I mean, the skills that kids need for where we're going as a society, you know, coding and systems knowledge and being able to adapt in addition to everything. I don't know. I think there will be some aspects of this that are being amplified, and it's actually hurting. So here's a case. In Minnesota, this past school year, Minnesota was directed to do supplementary education at their school. So basically saying that we know that the kids are behind because we went online. So this year you have to teach what you would have taught last year plus this year. Well, how do you do that, right? Because you already have everything slotted into a certain amount of time and you're not increasing the length of day for kids. So, and you're not just going to dump all this extra stuff onto kids. Like, so there were just weird ways that people tried to get with this, but I don't know. I'm kind of more like this researcher, more skeptic on. I think there are some things that are going to come out of this that we will be surprised at in a positive way. I don't know what those will be, but I don't know if this like minus 1 or 2 year skills thing will show up. That where it's going to show up, though, I will make an amendment to that. Where it will show up is speech language skills. So I'm a speech language pathologist, and I saw this last year. Younger kids who are having some difficulty with especially sound production, S's, T's, Z's, TH's. When you wear a mask, and I wrote about this in the book, objectively through the American Speech Language Hearing Association, they were checking it, and the mask would knock down the decibel level, I don't know, by 6 decibels or whatever. But if you're trying to learn like an S and TH and Z sounds in the front of your mouth, and it's covered up by a mask, right? Kids weren't getting the visual feedback on that, and also they weren't getting the audio feedback. So a lot of those are showing up, a lot of speech, especially speech articulation sounds. Not so much language, but yeah. Kids, when I'm a speech therapist, right, if I work with kids, it's, you know, look at me. This is how you do the L sound. You know, put your tongue out a little bit and put your teeth down like you're biting in the end of your tongue. And, you know, like, oh, and so you're so visual with that. And that innately is just there when kids are learning. Now, again, you have a mask on. The kid has, you know, a mask on, so you can't quite hear what they're saying either. So I actually did therapy sessions with some students who were struggling with articulation and kind of came out of retirement to get on. And I did teletherapy with a handful of students where, you know, I didn't wear a mask. They didn't wear a mask, right? Because teletherapy. And we worked really hard and brought out those sounds that weren't there because of the natural feedback you weren't getting. So I think that's where it's going to it'll manifest. I mean, there'll be other areas, but yeah.
No, that's good. That's what we're driving towards, and that's kind of the information I want to get out. But I've got another interesting follow-up to all that. You're right about the sounds and the technical end of it. Let's talk about the practical end of it, where communications within groups. Because, like you said, going from Zoom back into whatever university, either the school, the classroom, or the office, or wherever, there's a difference of communications between looking at a camera and looking at a screen versus looking at your coworkers or your classmates.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Just understanding the dynamics of how to take turns and interact with your group. And right now, everything's socially distanced. And so those things get quirky. I had one of my new superintendents. So the first time superintendent and he was in class and in the graduate class that I was teaching. And he talked about a socially distanced fire drill that they had at their elementary school. And so he gets into this a little bit. And then, we just talked about it kind of as a group. And he didn't realize until we started to talk about it, right, that, of course, the pressure was there to do socially distance everything. So you're applying social distance. It becomes part of your lexicon, right? So it's not just vocabulary. If I say social distance to you, you know I'm telling you basically to stay 6 feet away from me. So so that got conveyed in weird ways in schools. So again, this fire drill where students were supposed to spread out in a classroom and then like one would leave and then they would count to like 1, 2, 3, and then the next kid would leave and they'd have to, and I'm just like, but you never would do it that way, right? Like that would never happen, or it should never happen.
I'm sitting here thinking, if this was a real fire and you were exiting the building this way, which kid becomes a victim? Right, because of the timing of this all.
No, right. Absolutely. So, so weird things like that. And so we saw these, transferred back and forth into people trying to adapt these. It was pretty, I don't know. People were trying to do the best that they could. It was real nonsensical when you just stood back and you looked at it and said, well, right? I mean, a fire drill, we get everybody out as fast as we can. There would never be a change to that. So, I think just the social skills, right, too. This natural loss as kids on, what you're doing together at a playground or kickball or things like that, and, dividing up teams and things. And all of those kind of natural things that happened that didn't happen and really couldn't happen in that remote setting. I don't know how fast kids will kind of pick that up, what that'll look like. So yeah, that's a good question.
So the other, you're familiar. Well, we're not going to bash my local school district first and foremost.
Okay.
This is informative information for the record. They didn't renew the last superintendent, right? So they hired a new one. He was here for all of less than a year. And then the school board found out via the internet that he accepted a position in another district and didn't bother to tell them.
Yeah, that's not classy. That's not the way you want to go out. So, goodness.
Especially when you have 2 years left on your current deal.
Yeah. Yeah. No. That's unfortunate. The thing is, superintendents, for example, this was back in School of Airs when that came out in 2019. A superintendent will last 2 to 3 years in a position, and that's it. And they're going somewhere else because it's highly political, and your school board that get voted for you to be hired, they get voted out. And so there's a new school board, maybe they don't like you and your initiatives. And it's just a position that doesn't have a lot of longevity. Now, you can be a superintendent for a long time. It's just you have to keep switching districts in order to do that. Even in kind of the best case scenarios, there's just a lifespan on that position right now. So the whole thing, right, continuity just gets crazy. And how do you do this whole thing of and masking, right? So, I didn't write about it in the book, but I was dealing with this nonstop with my students. And some of my students would come in my superintendent class, and they'd say, hey, like, our district was just sued for, like, its mask policy. So I'd find the lawsuit, and we would break down the lawsuit of saying, okay, what are they claiming, and what does this likely mean for you? Like, are your files going to be harvested by a law firm, and they're going to go through like how you made decisions on masking or not masking, how you're sanitizing things. And so we really broke it down. But that was so weird from what, you know, school to school, like how they would sanitize, mask, or athletics, right? Some schools would make you wear a mask if you're playing basketball, others wouldn't. And it was like, whatever the home school did would be the rule. And I mean, it was so weird. I mean, like, nothing was consistent. And one of the questions I asked was with environmental services, because I wrote an article about MRSA, the skin eating bacteria, right? The flesh eating bacteria. I wrote an article maybe 3-4 years ago. And I said, it is a pretty big issue in schools, and especially in weight rooms and locker rooms and other things. But how, so schools measure for MRSA, they measure for mold. That's very common. You probably have heard of it, or you know, in the chat, you probably hear, you know, like, this school is going to be closed 2 weeks for mold mitigation, black mold or something like that. That's, I was in two school districts where that happened. That's not uncommon. So I went to these environmental agencies and I said, can you test for the virus on hard surfaces, or like during a basketball game, could you do an air sample? And they're like, sure, we can do all of that. I mean, they're like, absolutely. And then I said, has anybody asked you to do that? And they said, absolutely not. Absolutely nobody is asking us. And so my question was, well, why not? And I thought the question, my answer to that was, well, if you find out that, you know, the virus is in the air, even though kids are wearing masks during a basketball game or whatever, what do you do then? Or if it's in, you know, the surface in a school, if it's on a wall or on tables or, you know, kind of wherever, what do you do? Do you shut the whole place down? What's your mitigation? So I think there were some schools in Texas, I think, that made it public and just said, we don't want to know because we don't want to deal with the possible mitigation efforts. We don't want to deal with having to shut down the whole district. And at that time, nobody really knew. I mean, there were schools buying ultraviolet lights, you know, and custodians would go around with these things, these Ghostbuster backpacks with, you know, fungicide, germicide, whatever, and spraying it on stuff. And I'm like, that's just theater. Like, you don't know unless you're actually going in and measuring, taking these samples, like with mold, like you could do this. So, you know, again, not so much in the book, but I think it goes to my mindset in the book of how do you objectively get information to verify things, right? So in that case, you know, going right to a few of these environmental services companies and say that work with schools on these other things. Could you do this? Yep. Anybody asking you? No. So, yeah.
Well, yeah, but then, like you said, yeah, it wouldn't be the liability and the mitigation and all the other things that go with knowing. Once you know something, you're on the hook for it. But if you don't know, you don't know.
Yeah, and they weren't required to do it, right? So, yeah, no one was going to go down that road. So, wow.
So, back to the internet information thing. I think you mentioned that the pandemic of 1918, almost mixed those numbers up, but close enough. Either way, we've got so much information now that our head spins, I think, right?
Right.
Back in the day, they got a newspaper, if they were lucky.
No, you're right. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, newspaper, yep.
So, I mean, we're getting information. I'm getting information every 15 seconds now.
Right, yep.
From my chat room, right? So, how did that impact us? Misinformation, yeah. Real information, just information.
So I wrote extensively about that. You're right on, Jim. So one of the things I said is, you know, in the cell phone age where we are at right now, it's nonstop. And it's something where, remember, you know, we were all getting these emails from, hey, like, you shopped at Target or, you know, Calvin Klein or Costco, and we're here for you, you know, and all this. We got these emails, and all, everything was, we could, like, you know, Chuck Mack getting that map of Pittsburgh, and in real time, you know, he said, I could see what was happening. So that type of thing, if you don't unplug from it, right, it'll burn you out, just flat out. It's called finite voltage. It's a term from John Apple in World War II, where you look at soldiers in high stress situations, and soldiers, once they got to about 90 days without a break, they would either be killed, captured, mental collapse, or missing in action. But largely, they see this mental collapse of soldiers who are in stressful situations, not necessarily conflict. You could be like a sniper, right, and be in a very high stress situation. But if you were in there for like 90 days and didn't have a break. So there's this thing called wet bulb effect. And I did a podcast on it pretty recently, and I wrote about this wet bulb effect, where it's kind of like humidity, right? It's like today, actually, where I'm at, it's hot and it's humid. So if you go outside, if you sweat, you don't evaporate, you don't cool down. So when we get all this information coming from our phones, and you turn on the TV, right, and everything, especially back in March, April, is about, here's how to sanitize your phone, and, you know, ABC Nightly News, you know, if you use this antacid, it might be promising in, you know, mitigating the virus. So people go out and get that, and everything people were talking about, every phone call, every whatever it was. And so needing to aggressively kind of use that Parkinson's law and saying, I'm going to, you know, I know it's hard, right, but I'm only going to consume some of this at certain times, or I'm going to stay with my member check to always kind of bring me back to an objective, more objective reality. But there were people that lost it with this finite voltage. And I wrote about some of those situations where, you know, people living in a small town in, I don't know if it was Mississippi, like less than 300 people were convinced, you know, that the town was going to riots and protest and all of this. And nothing was happening in that town, but right, it was, they were seeing it on the news. There was nothing close to them happening like that. But you can, and you have to watch this, not only in yourself, right? This whole negative expectation. So back in 1938, Orson Welles did War of the Worlds. Remember, the Martians are invading. They were in Pennsylvania, Jim. They were all over these big craft. You probably heard about it. So I don't know if they were in Pennsylvania, but
well, of course, War of the Worlds. I mean, we had Mars, Pennsylvania. They were here.
Were they there? Okay, so you know, I think you downed a few of those craft, and they're on display right now. But War of the Worlds. So people were listening to this about this play, right? About Martians, this radio theater about Martians landing on Earth and having these big, you know, structures that they're walking around and stuff like that. And a lot of people believe that. And there was a study, Professor Cantrell. I think from Stanford, met with people like right after that with his research team, and he's interviewing people like, you know, what happened? And people authentically were saying like they either saw the Martians, right, or there were marks out in their field. Farmers, police officers were saying, of course, none of this was real. The radio thing was real, but one of the things people did is they didn't try to verify it. They just, if they would have turned to a different radio station, they would have learned, right, that it wasn't broadcast anywhere else. But there was a bigger part of that, Cantrell said. You know, everybody back then, this was 1938, they knew that Europe was going to war. So all what you're hearing in the news that you're getting in America is, you know, Europe is going to go to war. World War II is going to start. And you're also worried, are we going to get news that the U.S. is going to enter the war? Of course, this is three years before Pearl Harbor. But so you already had this negative bias, this negative information bias. You expected the information to be really bad that you're going to get, no matter kind of what it was on a national level. So it was easier for people, the thought, right, between the researchers was it was easier for people to believe these Martians in 1938 because they already expected to get really, really bad news about something that was going on. And that actually plays out because when I wrote in School of Airs back in 2019 about the 9/11 in Lower Manhattan, 500,000 people were rescued in 9 hours when the Twin Towers fell. And people went to Battery Park. And at that time, it was different. It wasn't this, they expected something negative. Like before the Twin Towers, I mean, you know, the 90s, I mean, the U.S. was powering along pretty well. right? So people, when they went to the harbor, they expected there would be a rescue force there because they had always kind of seen this growing up, right? That there was the U.S. versus, like, you know, the Soviets and whatever. And if anything happened, then the military would jump in. So people went there and they expected this rescue force, and those could have just been boaters, like, getting off of the water. But they're like, you know, maybe we're next, right? So the mindset was different. So I guess where I'm trying to go with that is, if you expect bad news, like in the start of the pandemic, every time we got onto our phones, we probably were getting bad news, right? Negative themed news, or we were seeking it out. Like, we were just addicted to it. Like Charles Mack talked about that map on his phone where he could see Pittsburgh. And he said, for a week, I'm just like refreshing. Is my neighbor now? Is this area blue? And, you know, what does this mean? Am I going to have to take a different way to work? You know, like, literally, are they going to shut down these neighborhoods or not have deliveries, or can realtors no longer show homes in these areas? Or what if after the pandemic, you know, you have to reveal that, yes, someone had COVID who lived in this home, you know, and you're selling the house like today. I mean, all these things, like, we're just hitting at once. So that is the part of understanding too at 90 days. So if you do the things of Phase Validity, Get Out, I Observed, you do your member check network, you build up that five people, those are big parts of resiliency to this. And once you burn out, it's really hard to come back from that. Like, there are people who will never recover from that. The essential, non-essential. Remember the day in March all of us woke up and we were essential or non-essential? That destroyed, you know, careers and livelihoods and industries, right? And for other people, it rocketed them forward. I mean, if you were already a teletherapist for mental health or something, like, your business exploded. I talked to a CPA friend of mine who had a few clients like that. And he said it was off the records, you know, for them. But he said, I had a client who was a dentist and, you know, was shut down for at least a month and had no idea how you would start back up and this thing, and said it was catastrophic. And then, right, if you're a truck driver, we didn't do a parade for truck drivers who, you know, were told to work longer hours and the way stations were shut down. I interviewed, you know, truck drivers but we did parades for healthcare workers, for nurses. We had our fire trucks and police coming out, even though our police force was socially distanced. And like in Detroit, the police force was down 25%, was out with COVID, yet they were told to put on these parades. So this whole essential, non-essential is going to be with us for generations. And it's weird. Get this, Jim. When I do presentations about the book, half the people do not remember that they were deemed essential or non-essential. They don't remember it at all. And I thought, like, that was a unifying thing. It's early in the book. It's like page 4. I talk about a barber, Carl Mankey, in Ossawa, Michigan, being deemed non-essential. He was 70 years old. He kept coming to work, right? And the state's trying to shut him down. And so I'll present, and then people don't deny that it happened. But they'll come up afterwards and they'll say, oh, yeah, like, I totally forgot. And I said, you didn't forget, right? You blocked it out. We don't forget about those things. I mean, you blocked it out. So it's this traumatic event for you.
I was going to say, I'd be interested to learn what the ratio of those people who are non-essential who don't remember.
I mean, that would be a fascinating study, right? I mean, to get into that from a university level. So I think there would be some really cool lines of inquiry for people doing research on kind of that human condition, as you said, to break it down into that essential and non-essential, and if you recall it or not. I mean, for some people, you suddenly became hyper important, right? And it was a little bit of social cachet and things like that. And some people admitted it. You know, they felt more important than they had at other times in their life. And other people, again, like that one dentist who said, oh my God, I just, you know, maybe chose a profession that is, you know, I'm in big trouble here. You know, what if they say you can only have X number of patients and you have to have all these expensive processes and certifications to remain, you know, a sterile, virus-free dental office. So that was a weird thing. I thought it was very important in the book, and it's very well done. But yet when I present on it, it's like, it's kind of like waking people up from a dream. And I didn't expect that at all. I thought this would be like so much of a unifying thing. So I think it's amazing.
But it turned into such a divisive thing now. Like, there's no unification. I mean, you mentioned 9/11 earlier. Like, we all became, oh, not all, right? But it felt like everybody was on board then. But now it's so divisive that the sky's blue, but 45% of people don't believe that.
Right. No, you're right. So that's a difference too. I mean, this chaos event has not unified us. And part of it is, I also wrote about, I know we're getting toward the end, I wrote about the Committee for National Morale. And that was it in the start of World War II. It actually, I think it was in 39. Frank Capra, Dr. Seuss, you know, the Dr. Seuss books, Ted Geisel. But there were a sophisticated committee put together of propaganda for coming into like World War II in the U.S. And there were these big art displays and museums, like showing people, you know, like gardening in front of their house or getting ready for war. But like people, you know, from kids to adults and all this stuff. And the road to victory, you know, if you want to look it up, it's really amazing. And how these billboards and what you'd see in magazines and reels at the start of movies and stuff like that. So it was really this unifying response, and people responded to that very well. But we don't have anything like that today. I wrote about it in the book. What we should have had in March of 2020 for like a unifying event would have been like a fitness and fortitude campaign. So, you know, everybody can log in a portal, right? And whatever fitness things you could do at home. And then maybe if you log in for 10 days, you get a discount from your Amazon order, or you can do a group thing, right? You can do a competition board, maybe with other family and friends. But that actually existed with the U.S. Army. It was built in 2016, and they could have scaled it out. So I talked about that too. Like, it wasn't that big of a request to do this, like to make people feel involved. And the other part is National Institute of Health came out at the start of the pandemic. And I wrote about it too. And even Dr. Fauci saying, you know, if you are more physically fit, you're more likely to do better, right? During any health event, like you're less likely to either contract it, or if you do contract it, you're more likely to survive it if you're more fit. So that was just obvious. So where was this? There was no committee, and there still isn't a committee. Like, we don't have anything now on, right, gas prices are high, inflation. Why isn't there a committee on like civilian agricultural resilience, like how to, if you live in an apartment or you live, you know, residential, you know, single house or farm or whatever, how can you produce more food, right? What are some simple things to do that can increase, or how you can use food in different recipes, right? More maybe abundant things. Like, why don't we have that? Why isn't there a czar of that? And why don't we have that on the news?
So I'm going to interrupt you because I got to ask this question for Geo Observation, because he's been making me ask it the last few weeks, because we're almost out of time. Yikes. Favorite breakfast?
Oh, favorite breakfast. Boy, scrambled eggs and bacon and ham.
Oh, you're going for it, right?
And black coffee, yeah.
Well, David, hey, I do appreciate you, and it has been immensely informative, I think. I don't want to say fun tonight, but it's been informative.
It's been fun and informative, yeah.
And but now, what's your website one more time before we run out of time?
Yeah, safetyphd.com.
So how you mentioned the show earlier? We got 30 seconds left. How's the show been doing?
What show? My podcast?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, podcast has been doing well. So I started it back up in 2021. I did a hiatus when I was writing the book because I needed to put the time in. So. Good. Had a show last night.
Man, it's been too short. We have to get back. We have a whole bunch of other things we need to talk about sometime.
Yeah. And always an honor.
Thank you, sir. And for everybody else, have a good night and good week, and we'll talk to you soon. I think that's the right time. Maybe. Oh man, I need to write these things down. No, I'm not there yet. Here we go. I'm gonna hit it for Germantown Runner right now. thank you for joining us.
Are we still good tonight?
I hope you're
playing outro music.
Take a few moments, subscribe, share, all the fun stuff. You know how to do it. I don't have to tell you. Just be ready for next week. It'll be sooner than you think.
Bruce Martin, host of Pit Pass Indy. Each week, I go behind the scenes of the NTT IndyCar Series and introduce our listeners to the biggest stars of IndyCar, which features the Indianapolis 500 as its cornerstone event. The men and women that compete in IndyCar may be the bravest athletes in all of sport, as danger lurks around every corner. They are able to look danger in the eye without flinching. That is why the NTT IndyCar Series features the best racing on the planet. Join me every week as we talk to the stars of IndyCar, including the legends of the Indianapolis 500, on Pit Pass Indy from Evergreen Podcasts.